Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson, your host and guide.
And I'm Sam Kennedy, ready to connect the dots.
And today, well, we're tackling what has to be one of the most consequential four-day stretches of federal activity we've seen in quite some time. Just relentless.
Absolutely relentless. A real deluge of information coming out of Washington, covering everything from, let's see, Friday, September 19th, right through today, Monday, December 22nd, 2025.
Yeah, exactly. So our mission today is a comprehensive deep dive into, well, pretty much every major action taken by the U.S. federal government during this very short window. The title for this one is The Federal News Update for Monday, September 22nd, 2025.
And we've pulled together a frankly, enormous stack of reports. We're talking transformative executive actions, really severe legislative gridlock, some pivotal military developments, and honestly, dramatic shifts in public health norms, institutional rules. It's a lot.
It really is. Our goal, as always, is to try and extract the critical implications from all this noise so you can quickly grasp what's fundamentally shifting in Washington, like right now.
And the initial takeaway, it's pretty stark, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Overwhelmingly, this period is defined by just the strategic and, frankly, aggressive use of executive power.
Mm.
It feels like an administration deliberately bypassing a Congress that's just stuck, hopelessly gridlocked.
And the immediate effect is this dramatic intensification of conflict. Really, across the entire federal system, you're seeing it with the courts, the press corps, even within agencies.
Right. What we're watching unfold, it doesn't feel like just incremental policy tweaks. It's more like a rapid, almost wholesale re-engineering of some pretty foundational American policies.
And often using mechanisms that completely sidestep any kind of congressional debate. That's key.
Okay, let's unpack this mountain of information. We absolutely have to start with what was probably the biggest shockwave, the one that hit late last week. I'm talking about the complete transformation of U.S. immigration policy, that September 19th pivot.
That pivot, yes. It fundamentally changes how America approaches both global talent and, maybe even more so, global capital. So on September 19th, Friday, a presidential proclamation comes out. It's titled Restriction on Entry of Certain Non-Immigrant Workers.
And analysts, I mean, universally, are calling this the de facto end of the H-1B visa program, at least for most users.
The mechanism they use is just staggering.
It really is.
The proclamation imposes this massive, almost prohibitive, $100,000 one-time fee on any new H-1B visa petition.
$100,000 per visa.
Per visa. And the effective date was incredibly short. It kicked in just 36 hours later, 12:01 a.m. Eastern Time, Sunday, September 21st.
So basically no time for anyone to prepare. Not the companies, not the visa holders, nobody.
Exactly. Absolute chaos. And that fee hike, it's just unprecedented. We're talking about increasing the cost by, what, a factor of 20? Existing fees were usually around $5,000, maybe a bit more sometimes, but nothing like this.
And the administration's justification, what are they saying?
Well, the official line, you know, articulated by folks like Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, is that the fee is needed to, quote, curb abuses, protect American jobs, and force companies to commit to training Americans.
Right, the usual arguments.
Yeah, and they add that the program should really only be reserved for the absolute top tier of specialized talent, the great engineers, and impressively detailed executives, as they put it.
But the immediate reaction on the ground, I mean, looking at reports from major tech firms, immigration lawyers, it wasn't seen as a restriction. It was seen as a wall. Pure pandemonium, absolute panic.
Precisely. Because the deadline was so immediate, Sunday morning, it acts as a barrier, not just a restriction.
Which raises that first key insight, doesn't it? This policy, it doesn't really feel like it's trying to curb abuse. It feels like it's trying to set up a barrier that maybe only mega corporations or, I don't know, incredibly wealthy individuals could possibly cross.
Exactly. And the whole protecting American jobs argument is already being challenged. We saw internal memos from companies like Meta, Amazon, Microsoft, basically telling their H-1B employees who were traveling abroad to rush back before that Sunday deadline.
And many couldn't make it, right?
Many couldn't. Flights booked, impossible timelines. It created real personal crises.
And the economic shockwaves, they're already hitting hard. It's not just Silicon Valley, is it?
Oh, not at all. I mean, think about it. Companies like Amazon and Microsoft, they had thousands of H-1B approvals just in the first half of 2025. You simply cannot sustain that kind of high-skilled hiring with a $100,000 per employee price tag. It's essentially a massive tax on every skilled worker coming into the country.
And the impact goes beyond tech. Higher education.
Hit hard. Universities rely heavily on H-1Bs to attract top global faculty, researchers, people working in fields critical to defense, innovation, you name it.
Healthcare too, I imagine.
Definitely. The healthcare sector uses these visas to fill specialized roles, particularly in rural or underserved areas. They're reeling too. Analysts are already predicting an immediate, and I mean immediate, acceleration of offshoring for high-skilled jobs.
Because if companies can't employ them here,
they'll just move those jobs elsewhere. Canada, Ireland, India, wherever the talent can actually work. Multinational companies have options.
So that move dismantles the skilled labor pathway, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And then, almost in the same breath, there's another action focused entirely on wealth, the gold card system.
That's the executive order, titled the Gold Card, signed the very same day, September 19th. And this initiative, it creates a direct wealth-based pathway to getting a green card, lawful permanent resident status.
It's a stunning philosophical shift, isn't it? Residency is basically being monetized.
Completely.
Yeah.
It replaces that idea of merit-based talent acquisition with just pure capital infusion.
Let's talk about the price tags, because they are eye-watering. For an individual to get this gold card,
it requires a $1 million gift, that's the term they use, a gift directly to the U.S. Treasury, plus, you know, processing fees, estimated around $15,000, and you still have to pass standard background checks and vetting.
$1 million gift for a green card, wow. And the corporate version?
The corporate gold card is maybe even more revealing. It requires a $2 million contribution per employee. But the really interesting mechanism here is transferability.
Meaning,
if that highly paid employee eventually leaves the company can apply that original $2 million investment towards a new foreign hire. They just pay a transfer fee and some annual maintenance costs.
So it creates this kind of institutionalized capital pool specifically for hiring wealthy foreign nationals.
Exactly. It's less about the individual, more about the company buying access slots.
And they're already teasing an even higher tier, right? The platinum card.
Yeah, the upcoming Trump platinum card. Advertised price. A cool $5 million. And this premium tier is supposedly designed to let holders spend up to 270 days a year in the U.S. without paying U.S. taxes on their income earned outside the U.S.
Okay, that last part, the tax benefit, that surely needs Congress, right?
Oh, almost certainly. That kind of tax change can't just be done by executive order. That'll require legislation. But the intent is clear.
So when you put the H-1B fee hike and the gold card system side by side, what's the single message?
The message seems pretty clear. The U.S. is shifting hard from a system that, at least nominally, prioritized attracting specialized human capital.
Skills, knowledge.
Right, to one that explicitly prioritizes attracting financial capital. It feels like a deliberate pivot towards, well, plutocracy, away from meritocracy, at least within this immigration context.
We absolutely have to talk about the global fallout from it, especially in India. India is the source country for, what, over 70% of H-1B holders?
That's right, based on fiscal year 2024 data. And the reaction from New Delhi was immediate and pretty volatile.
What happened?
The Indian government issued a formal statement expressing serious concern, pointing to both the humanitarian impact on their citizens and the economic risks.
And the markets.
The Indian IT sector took a hit. Share prices for giants like Infosys, Tata Consultancy Services, they slumped noticeably on Friday and into Monday morning trading. And among the Indian diaspora, reports described absolute chaos. People scrambling, paying huge sums for last-minute flights to try and beat that Sunday deadline. Families separated, careers thrown into limbo.
But there's a potentially fascinating strategic consequence here, maybe an unintended one. This idea of accelerated garwapsi.
Yes, garwapsi, meaning homecoming. Experts are suggesting that this policy might actually force a lot of highly skilled Indian professionals, people with valuable Silicon Valley experience, global networks, maybe even some capital now, to return to India.
Because they simply can't stay or come to the U.S. anymore under the old system.
Exactly. And if that happens on a large scale, this U.S. protectionist measure could, ironically, end up being a massive economic gift to India, a key geopolitical competitor.
How so?
It could significantly boost India's own tech and innovation hubs. You're essentially sending back experienced talent that could accelerate their internal growth, potentially at the direct expense of U.S. innovation and competitiveness. It's a classic example of potential unintended consequences when you prioritize one-factor capital so heavily over another talent.
Okay, so that's the executive branch, acting decisively, maybe recklessly depending on your view, completely reshaping policy overnight. Now let's pivot to the other side of Pennsylvania Avenue, the legislative branch.
And the contrast couldn't be starker, could it? We go from rapid-fire executive action to just deep, paralyzing gridlock in Congress.
Total dysfunction seems like the right phrase.
Yeah.
The federal government is now staring down a highly probable shutdown after the September 30th funding deadline. Why? Because Congress simply cannot agree on a continuing resolution, a CR, to keep the lights on.
We saw this play out vividly on Friday, September 19th. The Senate tried to pass two competing funding measures. Both failed.
Okay, break those down for us.
First, there was the Republican-led CR, H.R. 5371. It came over from the House and proposed funding the government for 7 weeks at current levels. It failed on a 44-48 vote. Needed 60 votes to break the filibuster.
And the vote dynamics there were interesting, weren't they? Not purely party line.
Not entirely. It mostly failed along party lines, but two key Republicans, Senators Rand Paul and Lisa Murkowski, actually voted against their own party's bill. And one Democrat, Senator John Fetterman, crossed the aisle to vote for it, shows the internal fractures even within the parties.
Okay, and the Democratic alternative?
That was S2A82. It focused heavily on trying to address some expiring health care provisions, particularly the ACA tax credits. That one also failed, 47-45, this time strictly along party lines, zero crossover.
So the core deadlock, the sticking point, is what exactly?
It really centers on those expiring Affordable Care Act tax credits. Democrats, led by Minority Leader Schumer, are insisting that these credits, which help millions of Americans afford health insurance premiums, must be addressed now within this funding bill.
And Republicans.
They refuse. They argue against attaching these kinds of policy riders to what should be a clean stopgap measure just to avoid a shutdown. They want to debate policy separately. Fundamentally different approaches to must-pass legislation.
Was there anything they agreed on in these bills?
Well, one small thing to note. The House-passed GOP bill, the one that failed in the Senate, did include $88 million specifically for security funding.
For who?
For Congress itself, the Supreme Court, and the executive branch. This was added largely in response to the recent assassination of Charlie Kirk, reflecting heightened security concerns in D.C.
A necessary measure? Probably, but clearly not enough to bridge the bigger gap.
Not even close. And now, the procedural situation is basically a high-stakes game of chicken.
Because they're going on recess.
Exactly. Both chambers are out of session until later next week because of the Rosh Hashanah holiday. The Senate comes back on September 29th, but the House Republicans aren't scheduled back until October 1st, the day after the funding deadline.
So the House GOP leadership essentially dropped their bill and left town.
Pretty much. They packaged the funding bill they wanted and walked away, effectively daring the Senate Democrats to either accept the House version when they return or take the blame for triggering an immediate shutdown. It's very strategic, some would say cynical, use of the recess.
And the consequences of a shutdown, let's be clear, they aren't just political theater. They hit real people,
yeah.
Real services.
Oh, absolutely. A shutdown means federal agencies have to stop all non-essential discretionary functions. First and foremost, that means thousands of federal workers get furloughed. They're sent home without pay until Congress acts.
And what else stops? Let's get specific, granular about the impact.
Okay, well, you'd see the immediate closure of all national parks and monuments. Huge delays in processing passports, which is a nightmare if you need to travel internationally.
Mm.
Critical scientific work gets halted. Think about the National Institutes of Health, the NIH. They wouldn't be able to admit new patients into clinical trials. No new research grants processed. Medical breakthroughs literally stopped in their tracks.
That's significant. What about social programs?
The biggest immediate worry there often involves SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program food stamps. While the benefits themselves might be funded for a short period, the system supporting them can break down.
Oh.
The local stores, the supermarkets, they need licenses to accept the EBT cards people use for SNAP benefits. During a shutdown, the renewal process for those licenses can halt. If stores can't accept the cards, millions of vulnerable families could face immediate widespread difficulty buying food. It's a potential failure of just basic government machinery.
So this stark contrast, legislative paralysis on one side and on the other, this incredibly aggressive executive branch redefining its authority, trying to control information, shaping civil liberties.
Yes. And this is where the battle over the actual structure and future of the government really heats up, particularly around things like the First Amendment and the independence of the Justice Department.
Let's start with the Pentagon, or rather, the Department of War, the DOW, as it was recently rebranded. On Friday, September 19th, they rolled out some really sweeping new restrictions on the press.
Sweeping and deeply controversial. The policy is, frankly, shocking in its scope. It requires any journalist hovering the department to sign a formal pledge.
A pledge about what?
A pledge agreeing not to obtain or publish any unauthorized information, even if that information is unclassified.
Wait, even if it's not classified?
Correct. If a reporter refuses to sign this pledge, their credentials get revoked immediately. They're effectively barred from covering the military or defense matters from official facilities or briefings.
That sounds like a muzzle. An attempt to ensure only the official government-approved story about the military gets out.
That's exactly how press freedom organizations reacted. They were instantly up in arms.
Which groups? What do they say?
Groups like the National Press Club, the Freedom of the Press Foundation, they immediately condemned it, called it a direct assault on independent journalism. And crucially, they identified it as a form of prior restraint.
Prior restraint. That's a serious First Amendment term, right? Explain that.
It's one of the most serious First Amendment violations.
Right.
Prior restraint means the government is trying to stop publication before it happens rather than dealing with any potential harm after publication. The Supreme Court has almost always struck down prior restraints as unconstitutional.
Can you give us a concrete example? How might this pledge actually play out for a reporter doing their job?
Okay, imagine a journalist is reporting on, say, military readiness at a base. They talk to a source, maybe just a staff sergeant, who mentions offhand, not classified, just unauthorized, that because of budget cuts or the shutdown threat we just talked about, maintenance on a certain type of helicopter is falling behind schedule.
Okay. Seems like important public information.
Right. But under this pledge, if the journalist publishes that perfectly legitimate, unclassified but unauthorized information, they could lose their credentials, their access. It would absolutely chill any kind of investigative reporting or even just reporting basic facts that the brass doesn't want highlighted. It also discourages anyone inside from speaking up.
Now, interestingly, didn't the president seem to slightly distance himself from this?
Well, yeah, that was odd. On Sunday, President Trump made comments suggesting he didn't think the Pentagon should necessarily be in charge of this policy, adding something like, nothing stops reporters, but the policy itself remains in force.
So, a contradiction, or just political noise?
Hard to say. It signals a clear tension, at the very least, between the political leadership and perhaps the uniformed military or civilian leadership at W who implemented this. The policy stands, though.
Okay, moving from the press to the courts. The Justice Department has also been busy taking aggressive action on civil rights issues, specifically with passports.
That's right. On September 19th, the DOJ filed an emergency appeal directly with the Supreme Court regarding passport policy.
What are they trying to enforce? What's the specific issue?
They're seeking to enforce a policy that would restrict the gender markers allowed on U.S. passports to only male or female, based exclusively on the sex listed on the applicant's original birth certificate.
And this aligns with a broader executive order.
Yes. It aligns directly with President Trump's Executive Order 14168, which mandates that federal agencies recognize only two distinct biological sexes. This move effectively reverses the previous State Department policy that allowed individuals to select an X marker if they identified as non-binary.
What's the core legal argument the administration is making to the Supreme Court?
Their argument is fundamentally about government definition. They claim, and I quote loosely, that the Constitution does not prohibit the government from defining sex in terms of an individual's biological classification. They're essentially challenging the idea that the government can be compelled to recognize non-binary identities on official documents.
So this Supreme Court case could be really pivotal in defining the federal government's stance on gender identity recognition.
Absolutely. It will test the reach of EO 14168 and set a major precedent on how federal documents handle gender markers.
Meanwhile, inside the Justice Department itself, there seems to be significant friction boiling over.
Yeah.
We saw a high-profile resignation.
Yes, a very significant one. Eric Siebert, who was the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia, a really key district, often handling sensitive political and national security cases, resigned abruptly on Friday, September 19th.
And the reporting suggests this wasn't voluntary.
Reports indicate he resigned under intense pressure from the administration. Specifically, pressure to launch investigations into prominent political figures perceived as enemies of the White House.
Names mentioned.
New York Attorney General Letitia James and former FBI Director James Comey were the main names cited in reports. Siebert apparently reviewed potential cases and concluded there was insufficient evidence to proceed with charges. His resignation followed that conclusion.
Wow. And the administration's reaction to his departure?
incredibly swift, which itself tells a story. By Saturday, the very next day, President Trump nominated Lindsay Halligan, a senior aide known for her work on election challenges, to replace Siebert.
And the justification for her nomination?
The White House statement explicitly cited her loyalty and her track record in the winning fight against the weaponization of our justice system.
Using the word loyalty to describe a nominee for U.S. attorney, that certainly raised some eyebrows.
It absolutely did. It fueled concerns about the politicization of the Justice Department, suggesting appointments are based on political allegiance rather than prosecutorial independence.
And the president didn't stop there, did he? He publicly called on the attorney general.
No, he amplified the pressure. He publicly urged Attorney General Pam Bondi to take action against other political figures he views as foes, naming James and Comey again, but also adding Senator Adam Schiff to the list.
And the reaction to that?
Immediate and fierce condemnation from critics. Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, many others, they called it a blatant abuse of power. The argument is that the president is openly attempting to use the federal justice system not to enforce the law impartially, but as a weapon against his political adversaries. This strikes at the core principle of DOJ independence.
So we have the executive branch pushing hard on the judiciary, trying to influence prosecutions. But there's also ongoing legal pushback against the administration on fundamental structural issues, right? Tell us about the civil service litigation, the AFGE v. Trump cases.
Right. That's a crucial battle playing out more quietly, but with huge implications. On September 19th, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit formally docketed those cases, meaning the litigation is actively moving forward.
Remind us, what's at stake in AFGE v. Trump? Why is it so important for, you know, the average person listening?
Because it directly challenges the president's power over the federal workforce itself. The core issue is whether the president has the authority to unilaterally reorganize federal agencies and conduct mass layoffs, what they call reductions in force, or RIFs without needing explicit approval from Congress.
It's about the separation of powers, though.
Exactly. It tests the balance between the executive and legislative branches when it comes to controlling the bureaucracy. If the president can fundamentally reshape agencies and fire large numbers of career civil servants at will, it drastically alters the checks and balances within the government.
Didn't the Supreme Court weigh in on this earlier?
They did, sort of. Back in July, the Supreme Court issued a temporary stay on a lower court's preliminary injunction. That basically allowed the administration to continue with some reorganization plans for the time being. But the Ninth Circuit case now will address the underlying merits. The final ruling will be critical in determining the long-term structure and, importantly, the independence of the federal civil service.
Okay, that paints a picture of pretty intense domestic conflict and maneuvering. If the administration is flexing this much institutional muscle at home, how is that translating onto the world stage? Let's shift now to foreign policy and national security.
Well, a key move on the diplomatic front was the Senate confirmation of Michael G. Waltz as the new U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. That happened on September 19th.
The vote was close, wasn't it?
Yes, quite narrow, 47-43. Waltz is a military veteran, former congressman, known for his strong conservative foreign policy views.
And his mission at the U.N.
He heads to the upcoming U.N. General Assembly with a clear America First mandate. His focus will be on pushing for UN reform, something the administration has long advocated and actively countering the influence of China and Russia within that international body.
Okay, what about strategic alliances? Any major developments there?
A very significant one, actually. Also, on September 19th, the administration signed what they called a historic technology prosperity deal with the United Kingdom.
Focused on what specific areas?
The agreement is designed to really dup in cooperation in two absolutely crucial future-defining tech sectors, artificial intelligence, AI, and quantum computing.
And this wasn't just a handshake deal, right? There was serious money involved.
Massive money. And interestingly, mostly private sector money catalyzed by the agreement. Microsoft announced a truly stunning $30 billion investment in the UK over the next few years.
$30 billion.
$30 billion. With half of that earmarked specifically for building out AI and cloud infrastructure in the UK. And almost simultaneously, Google's parent company, Alphabet, committed $6.8 billion to boost UK-based AI research, specifically supporting projects like their DeepMind subsidiary.
So this deal, backed by these huge investments, basically cements the UK as the US's primary global partner in these critical future technologies.
It certainly looks that way. It's a major strategic alignment, using private capital to achieve geopolitical tech goals.
Now, shifting regions to Central Asia, President Trump brought up something quite contentious on Friday, didn't he, regarding Afghanistan?
He did. He floated the idea quite publicly of reestablishing a U.S. military presence at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. He even called it breaking news.
Bagram, that was the main U.S. hub for two decades. Why now? What was his justification?
He explicitly linked it to countering China. He cited Bagram's strategic location, its proximity to what he described as China's nuclear weapons manufacturing areas, suggesting a return, even hypothetically, signals a potential major rethink of U.S. strategy in Central Asia after the 2021 withdrawal.
Has there been any reaction from the Taliban, who currently control Afghanistan?
Predictably, the Taliban leadership publicly rejected the idea of the U.S. returning to Bagram. However, there are also reports emerging that U.S. officials are actually preparing to enter into talks with the Taliban, exploring ways they might somehow regain access or establish some kind of presence there.
So talking to the Taliban about returning to Bagram, that sounds like an incredibly complex and fraught diplomatic path.
Extremely complex, yes. Full of political and security risks.
Before we move off defense matters, we really need to acknowledge a tragedy that occurred this past week.
Yes, absolutely. It's important to report that 4 Special Operations soldiers tragically died. Their U.S. Army MH-60 Black Hawk helicopter crashed sometime earlier in the week, likely around Wednesday, September 17th, during a training mission in Washington State, west of Joint Base Lewis-McChord.
And these weren't just any soldiers, right? They were part of a very elite unit.
That's correct. They were members of the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, Airborne, better known as the Night Stalkers. This unit is globally renowned for its expertise in conducting high-risk, complex aviation missions, often at night and in difficult conditions. The cause of the crash is now under full investigation. A terrible loss.
Indeed. Finally, on the military oversight front, there was a significant report from the DoD Inspector General released on Friday.
Yes, a watchdog report focused on military family housing, and it found some serious problems.
What kind of problems?
Systemic failures in how military housing offices were overseeing privatized housing contracts, specifically involving a company called Hunt Military Communities across 7 different installations.
And these weren't just bureaucratic failures, right? They had real-world consequences for families.
Absolutely. The IG found these oversight failures potentially allowed military families to move into homes with significant health and safety hazards, things like mold, pest infestations, serious electrical issues.
What specific things were the housing officials failing to do?
The report got quite granular. Officials were consistently failing to properly complete mandatory checklists before families moved in the change of occupancy maintenance checks. This meant they were skipping inspections of critical areas like crawl spaces and attics, which are prime spots for hidden mold or water damage.
And other safety checks.
Yes. Things like verifying that windows could actually be used for emergency egress, testing washer and dryer outlets for electrical safety, checking for gas leaks. Basic but vital safety measures were being missed.
Why were these checks being skipped? What did the IG find?
Several reasons. Chronic understaffing was a major factor. The report cited Fort Sam Houston, for example, where just 2 government staff were responsible for overseeing nearly 1,000 housing units. That's an impossible ratio.
Wow.
They also found a lack of clear technical guidance for the inspectors, and sometimes they just didn't have the right equipment, like moisture meters or gas leak detectors, to do the job properly. It points to a systemic failure to resource and prioritize this basic safety mission.
Was there anything about the contracts themselves?
Yes. Interestingly, the IG also found that the Army and Navy had developed performance incentive fee plans for the housing provider that didn't really align with the standard framework. Essentially, they might have been improperly incentivizing the housing company, rewarding them based on metrics that didn't necessarily correlate with ensuring the safety and well-being of the military families living there.
That's deeply concerning. Mm-hmm. Okay, that detailed look at defense and diplomacy brings us back to the domestic front. There are also some pretty significant policy shifts happening in public health and government data transparency, driven largely by executive influence.
Yes, on the public health side, probably the biggest news was a fundamental and, as you might expect, highly controversial pivot in the national guidance on COVID-19 vaccination.
This came from the CDC's advisory committee.
Correct. On September 19th, the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, known as ACP, voted unanimously to change the official recommendation for COVID-19 vaccines.
How did it change? It's no longer universal.
Exactly. The recommendation is no longer a blanket. Everyone should get it. Instead, the new guidance is based on individual decision-making for everyone aged 6 months and older. The advice is now to consult with your healthcare provider to weigh your personal risks and benefits.
What's the rationale behind that shift?
The committee argued that for the general population, especially those at lower risk of severe disease now, the individual risk-benefit calculation varies too much to justify a universal recommendation anymore.
And the reaction from the public health community?
A lot of pushback, especially from career public health experts. We saw figures like Richard Besser, a former acting CDC director, stating very publicly that this move undermines decades of established public health practice.
Why so?
His argument, and others share it, is that public health relies on expert consensus guiding universal recommendations for things like vaccines. Shifting to individual decision-making for something like COVID, they argue, erodes trust in public health institutions and could lead to confusion and lower uptake, even among those who might significantly benefit.
But what about access? Does this change affect insurance coverage?
That's a key point. The way the new guidance was structured, reportedly under direction from HHS, is specifically designed to ensure continued insurance coverage. So Medicare, Medicaid, and the Vaccines for Children, VFC program, should still cover the vaccine even without the universal recommendation. That was a deliberate technicality.
Okay. And that same committee, ACIP, they also made a decision about another childhood vaccine, the MMRV.
Yes, they did. The MMRV vaccine combines protection against measles, mumps, rubella, and varicella, chickenpox. The panel voted to recommend pushing back the administration of this specific combination shot until children are at least 4 years old.
Why the change there?
It relates to concerns about a very small but statistically identifiable increased risk of fevers and febrile seizures in children under four who receive that particular combined MMRV vaccine compared to getting the MMR and varicella shots separately.
So a safety signal, albeit a small one.
Right. And even though the risk is minor, the panel ultimately voted against having the Vaccines for Children program cover this specific combination product for younger children. It signals perhaps a heightened sense of caution around vaccine schedules for very young children.
Now, still on health, we're apparently expecting a major and likely very politically charged announcement from the administration today, specifically about autism. This seems linked to HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s focus.
That's the reporting. President Trump himself announced over the weekend that there would be a statement today regarding significant medical and scientific findings for America's children.
And the leaks or reports suggest this involves Tylenol and a potential treatment.
Yes. The expectation is that health officials, likely influenced by Secretary Kennedy's longstanding interest in finding environmental causes for autism, will raise concerns about pregnant women using acetaminophen, the active ingredient in Tylenol. And they may also promote a drug called leucovorin as a possible treatment for some forms of autism.
How does that align with the mainstream scientific consensus?
It really doesn't. The overwhelming scientific consensus attributes the documented rise in autism diagnoses primarily to better and earlier screening, and importantly, much broader diagnostic criteria than used in the past. There's no strong, widely accepted scientific evidence linking autism to acetaminophen use during pregnancy.
And promoting a specific treatment like leucovorin outside of rigorous clinical trials.
That's also highly controversial within the established medical community. Doing so raises serious concerns about promoting unproven therapies and potentially giving families false hope or steering them away from evidence-based interventions. It's definitely an announcement to watch closely today for its scientific basis or lack thereof.
Okay, shifting from health data to economic data. The administration also made a move to stop publishing certain reports.
Yes, on September 21st, the Trump administration announced it was terminating the annual publication of the government's household food security reports.
Those reports measure hunger and food insecurity across the U.S., right?
Mm-hmm.
What was the administration's rationale for stopping them?
The USDA issued a statement describing the reports as, quote, redundant, costly, politicized, and extraneous studies.
Politicized. Who relies on those reports and how are they seen as political?
Well, these reports have historically been the main benchmark used by researchers, food banks, state governments, and anti-poverty advocates to understand the scale and scope of hunger in America. They're crucial for targeting aid and resources. The administration seems to view them as politicized because the findings, the annual measurement of food insecurity, often become a focal point for critics who argue the government isn't doing enough to address poverty or that existing safety net programs are inadequate.
So by eliminating the report, they eliminate a key independent metric that's often used to criticize government performance on hunger.
That certainly seems to be the implication. It removes a prominent, data-driven tool for holding the government accountable on that specific issue.
Okay, let's move from these broad policy shifts to the federal bureaucracy itself. The last few days also saw some significant developments and, frankly, friction impacting the federal workforce. Starting with the CDC again, there was a quick reversal on telework.
Yes, a bit of whiplash there. Early last week, the CDC abruptly paused all approvals for telework requests that were being made as reasonable accommodations, presumably for employees with disabilities or medical conditions. This drew immediate fire from the union.
Which union? What was their argument?
The American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE, which represents many CDC workers. They called the pause a sweeping civil rights violation, arguing it potentially violated the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, and the Rehabilitation Act. They pointed out that many members had already been waiting months for decisions on their formal accommodation requests, so just pausing the process indefinitely was unacceptable and potentially illegal.
So the union pushed back hard, and the CDC responded.
They did. On Friday, September 19th, the CDC's HR office announced they were pausing immediate action on implementing that suspension. They said they needed to seek further clarification from the parent agency, HHS, about how to handle implementation issues.
So effectively, a temporary climb down.
It looks like it. The swift and strong legal pushback from the union seems to have forced the agency to, at the very least, hit the brakes and rethink how, or perhaps even whether, to proceed with that policy.
Interesting. Now, over at the Department of Veterans Affairs, there was news about pay for tech workers, something being terminated.
Yes, this is a big deal for the VA's ability to function effectively in the digital age. The VA's Office of Human Capital announced they are terminating the special salary rate, or SSR, for several key tech roles: computer engineers, computer scientists, and IT specialists. This takes effect very soon, on October 4th, 2025.
What exactly was this special salary rate? Why was it important?
The SSR was implemented back in 2023 specifically to help the VA compete with the private sector for badly needed tech talent. It resulted in an average pay increase of about 17% for roughly 7,000 VA tech workers.
And did it work? Did it help retention?
According to VA's own data, yes. It led to significantly higher retention rates among these critical employees. These are the people managing the VA's massive electronic health record system, telehealth platforms, all the digital services veterans rely on.
So now that pay incentive is gone. What happens to those employees' salaries?
They'll be placed back onto the standard government general schedule, GS locality pay tables, or possibly a retained rate if their current SSR pay is higher. But the bottom line is they lose that significant competitive pay advantage.
Which makes it harder for the VA to hire and keep the tech talent it needs.
Precisely. It severely diminishes the VA's ability to compete in what's already an extremely tight market for skilled IT professionals. It seems counterintuitive if the goal is to improve services for veterans. It echoes that philosophical theme we saw earlier, perhaps deprioritizing specialized talent relative to other goals.
Okay. On a more positive note regarding government operations, the General Services Administration, GSA, is moving ahead with a big project aimed at efficiency and savings.
Yes, GSA is launching its new centralized travel management system. It's called geo.gov. This is a huge undertaking, a 15-year contract with IBM worth over $930 million.
And it's supposed to streamline government travel. When does it launch?
It's set to go live with the first wave of agencies in November. That includes GSA itself and also the Department of Homeland Security's Federal Law Enforcement Training Centers, or FLETC.
And the expected savings?
They're significant. GSA anticipates geo.gov could save taxpayers up to $131 million annually just in direct travel cost savings, plus potentially $2 billion in administrative efficiencies over the full 15-year life of the contract by consolidating multiple legacy systems.
Okay, one last item on agency operations.
Yeah.
An update on the Federal Laboratory Consortium, They hit a milestone.
They did. The FLC marked its 50th anniversary. It's a crucial, though often overlooked, part of the innovation ecosystem.
What exactly does the FLC do?
It's essentially a nationwide network connecting federal labs where government R&D happens in areas like energy, health, defense, with the private sector. Their main job is technology transfer.
Meaning they help get government inventions out into the commercial market.
Exactly. They help move those taxpayer-funded technologies out of the lab and into the hands of businesses that can turn them into actual products and services. They do this by sharing best practices for tech transfer, running awards programs to highlight successes, and facilitating connections between labs and industry through things like partnership agreements and licensing early-stage technologies. It's the bridge from federal research to real-world innovation.
Got it. Okay, that brings us to the final major event we need to cover from this incredibly packed period, an event that really underscores the heightened political and cultural volatility in the country right now. The memorial service for Charlie Kirk held on Sunday.
Yes, the scale and nature of this event were remarkable. It was held at State Farm Stadium in Glendale, Arizona, and drew tens of thousands of attendees. So many, in fact, that they needed overflow seating at the nearby Desert Diamond Arena.
And the security matched the scale.
Absolutely. The Department of Homeland Security designated it a level one event. That's the highest possible security classification, usually reserved only for things like the Super Bowl or a presidential inauguration. It shows the perceived significance and potential risk associated with the gathering.
Who were the key figures present? It reads like a who's who of the current administration and conservative movement.
It really does. President Trump was there and spoke. Vice President J.D. Vance, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Senior Advisor and Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller. They were all prominent speakers or attendees. And perhaps most notably, business magnate Elon Musk was also present and seated with President Trump in a private suite during the event.
What was the main message from Charlie Kirk's family, specifically his widow?
His widow, Erica Kirk, delivered what many felt was the most powerful and emotionally resonant moment. She announced she intends to take over leadership of Turning Point USA, the organization her husband founded. But the statement that drew the most attention was her explicit declaration of forgiveness for the man accused of killing her husband, Tyler Robinson.
What did she say exactly?
She said, "The answer to hate is not hate," and made a point of saying she would defer any decision about punishment entirely to the legal system, a message of grace amidst tragedy.
That sentiment, though, it seems like it was quickly overshadowed by how others, particularly President Trump, used the event.
Very much so. President Trump's speech, by most accounts, frequently veered into territory that felt much more like a campaign rally than a eulogy.
How so?
He took numerous swipes at his political opponents. He repeated claims that Democrats cheated like dogs in the 2020 election. He also vowed to launch a federal crackdown on crime, specifically in Chicago, framing it as something done in Kirk's honor. But the most striking part was the rhetoric around conflict. He actually made a point of drawing a distinction between himself and Kirk's approach.
What did he say?
He said something to the effect of, "Kirk did not hate his opponents. That's where I disagreed with Charlie. I hate my opponents and I don't want the best for them. I'm sorry." It was a remarkably blunt statement defining his own political stance in contrast to the person being memorialized.
And he also weighed in on the fate of the accused killer, directly contradicting Erica Kirk.
Yes. While Erica Kirk called for deference to the legal system, President Trump explicitly called for the suspected shooter to receive the death penalty, a direct and very public contradiction of the widow's stated wish at her husband's memorial.
That rhetoric of conflict, was it echoed by others?
It was amplified, particularly by Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller. In his remarks, Miller declared that Kirk's political enemies cannot imagine what they have awakened, and claimed that the assassination had actually made Kirk immortal.
So clearly leveraging the death as a political rallying cry, framing it as martyrdom for their movement.
Precisely. The messaging from the political leadership very much used the memorial as an opportunity to energize their base and frame the political landscape as an existential battle.
And this political contention even spilled over into Congress, didn't it? With the resolution honoring Kirk.
It did. The House passed H.R.E.S. 719, a resolution simply titled Honoring the Life and Legacy of Charlie James Kirk. It passed overwhelmingly 310 to 58. But the significant part is that 58 Democrats voted against it.
Why is that significant?
Because it reveals a deep division, even within the Democratic caucus, about how to handle the legacy of a figure as polarizing as Charlie Kirk, even in the context of a memorial resolution after his death. It underscores just how fraught and contentious the political environment has become.
Wow. What an absolutely extraordinary and frankly exhausting 4 days of federal activity to track. Just recapping, we've seen the executive branch basically overhaul immigration policy overnight with that $100,000 H-1B fee.
Right.
We've seen direct challenges to core First Amendment rights with the Pentagon's press pledge. A complete pivot on national public health strategy for COVID. And all this while Congress remains utterly incapable of passing even a basic spending bill to avoid a shutdown.
It's really something. And if we try to connect all these dots, step back, and see the bigger picture from these last 4 days, I think three overarching trends really dominate.
Okay, what are they?
First, clearly, the primacy of executive action. The administration is strategically and aggressively using executive orders, proclamations, regulatory changes, whatever tools it can find, specifically to circumvent that gridlocked Congress.
Makes sense. What's the second?
Second is the escalation of institutional conflict. This isn't just policy disagreement anymore. It's direct conflict playing out across institutions between the White House and the judiciary, the press, the military brass, Congress, even within the federal workforce itself.
Right. We saw examples in almost every section. And the third trend.
The third is the consistent, unwavering advancement of a specific nationalist populist ideological agenda. And over these 4 days, that agenda seems to be crystallizing around certain values, explicitly prioritizing capital over specialized talent, as we saw with immigration, and favoring individual preference or political alignment over expert consensus, as seen in the public health shifts and maybe even the DOJ pressure.
Okay, so given those trends, what are the key flashpoints we need to watch moving forward?
Yeah.
What's the practical takeaway, the so what, for you, the listener?
Well, immediately, all eyes have to be on the legislative flashpoint, that looming government shutdown, how long it lasts, who blinks first, what deals are cut. The outcome will really define the power dynamic between the White House and Congress for the foreseeable future.
Makes sense. What else?
Then you have the legal flashpoints. We need to watch the courts very closely. The challenges to the H-1B fee, the gold card program, the Pentagon's media rule, these cases will be critical tests of the constitutional limits of presidential authority. And don't forget that AFGE v. Trump case deciding the future of the civil service itself.
And economically, what should people watch for?
Finally, the economic flashpoints. The clearest real-world indicators of the true cost or benefit of these new policies will likely show up in two key areas. First, the rate of offshoring. How quickly do companies actually move high-skilled jobs out of the U.S. now?
And second?
Second, watch the enrollment numbers for international students, particularly graduate students in STEM fields at U.S. universities. Will they decline sharply? Those metrics will give us a real sense of whether this new immigration strategy is boosting America or actually harming its long-term innovation and competitiveness.
It certainly feels like this period of, as you called it, deliberate and strategic disruption hasn't led to stability. If anything, it feels like it's set the stage for months, maybe longer, of sustained instability across almost every major sector.
Yeah, I agree. It really feels like the foundation for an entirely new, perhaps more confrontational phase of federal governance was laid just between Friday morning and today, Monday.
Which leads to a pretty provocative final thought, doesn't it?
It does. And it's a question for you, the listener, to really consider. Given the extreme partisan fiction we've just detailed, from the Senate floor failures to the charged rhetoric at the Kirk Memorial, is it even possible anymore for the federal government to function based on consensus building and compromise? Or have we maybe already transitioned, perhaps irreversibly, to a system where raw executive power and constant ideological warfare are seen as the only truly effective mechanisms for making rapid, meaningful change in Washington?